Blog Talk Radio.
This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing today?
Good. How about yourself? Good to hear your voice.
Doing pretty good. I was just reading some of the questions, and because our show today is about Hamilton's Law, which is more theory on evolutionary psychology and altruism and basically why we do anything. And so it reminded me of the first time I heard you speak. And I've talked about this in previous shows where the first time I heard you talk was a question about what is love. And you went through a beautiful explanation in terms of, you know, and you explained it mathematically about how the eggs are so much bigger than the sperm. And so it's just biologically more valuable and how it's scarce. And then the next day when you came, someone asked you, why do people do anything? And you launched into this incredible lecture about Hamilton's Law, which you kind of circled all the way around and didn't even mention Hamilton until the very end, which is, you know, very, very classic Dr. Lyle lecture. But it was fascinating because growing up, every time, you know, I tried to sound scientific with my friends, we'd always say, oh, survival of the fittest, survival of the fittest, survival of the fittest. And you went over how that's not actually the point of life. It's not survival of the fittest. And the example I remember you giving was that if it were true that it was survival of the fittest, then researchers would never observe a female lion defend her cub against a male's lion attack, because she would obviously be more fitter and she would never do that. And then the other argument was about survival of the species, in which case the male lion would never attack the cub if it was survival of the species. At which point you made the incredible case that it's actually neither of those two. It's survivals of the gene, in which case that turns into Hamilton's Law in terms of how do we know what gets favored more than the other. And so today's show is about that exact Hamilton's Law. And so I want to talk to you a little bit more about that and the implications of altruism and kin selection because of it. But before we kind of get to that, I had a question from one of the listeners that we can get to first. And the question is, Dr. Lyle, if you had unlimited funds, what causes or organizations would you donate to? Of course, in this hypothetical context, your donations would be anonymous, and so it hence would not be status seeking, and you wanted to maximize the leverage of the positive impact on future generations.
Yeah, that's a great question. Obviously, unlimited funds would make me czar. It would make me that I had control of all the resources in the world. All right, so I know what the person is speaking to. If I had a huge amount of funds at my discretion, and essentially, remember that you don't make things happen. You redirect energies. So so the question is, what would be a smart way for us to redirect energies that would be the most valuable projects? So I don't know enough about organizations to know what's a good organization, so I'm not going to wouldn't comment on that. But in principle, this is an in principle question, and the in principle question is, what kinds of ideas or projects are the most important in my view? In other words, do I think that we're very close to, quote, curing cancer, and that we should throw, you know, $1 trillion at that, and then we'll have that done, and it'll improve human life X amount, if that were true? Or should there be other ideas about, you know, save the whales or save the environment, et cetera, et cetera? What sorts of things would be the most worthwhile in terms of my personal view? I don't have a great deal of confidence in humans' ability to sort of pick an individual direction and to try to figure out where resources should be directed. I think they can do so, and they can do so with some degree of effectiveness. But that's fine. And I think the efforts that are being made by many people are very positive in this way. I'm sure that if I were to look at what the Bill Gates Foundation is up to, I probably think that they're probably doing a lot of good, I would assume. However, if I could change something about this Earth and its functioning within the realm of theoretical possibility, it would be that human beings the world over would more quickly hasten to understand the value of free societies, free enterprise, minimal government intervention, et cetera. So that is the single, I think if there's a frustration for some of us that have a good understanding of this, it's that human capability has actually now achieved really what it needs to achieve in terms of its understanding of how to manage resources in the environment, literally how to rearrange atoms in the service of human needs. We literally know enough right now for everybody to be in the world to be living at the level of the very comfortable upper middle class in the United States. So now, in order to get that all implemented, it might take, I mean, if you had political solutions to where it is that all governments understood that the best interests of humanity and everybody under those banners was a libertarian free enterprise situation, then that would probably be achieved in maybe 30, 40 years. That's how fast the world would probably move to get that accomplished. It's not hard to build a refrigerator once somebody's already figured out how to build it. And it's not difficult to build a very, very good electric car after they've already figured out how to do it. Just copying it is not hard. And so the extraordinarily difficult problem of actually making life really good and reasonable and physically easy and pleasant and orderly and safe, that has been achieved. It's been achieved in Western democracies. I live in such a set of circumstances, as do the vast majority of our listeners. And so this is very doable. And there's nothing magical about the United States or the resources here that had this happen. This was a political process that allowed human beings to use their intelligence and an incentive structure built into a market economy in order to accomplish this. So this would mean the most important thing that in principle we could do that would save probably the best theoretical net unit of return on investment would be if there could be methods to hasten human understanding and human political situations so that you could actually have a world where you did not have the kind of governmental problems that you have now. Now, it's not terrible. So right now it's very clear that the good guys are winning, that the systems that are more conducive to freedom are vastly more effective than the systems that are not. And so those systems are vastly outproducing and are going to be superior, far superior militarily, so they're going to be safe, reasonably safe. And they're going to be very superior in terms of how it is that people live. And they are inherently going to be stable because they're not, you know, it's not going to be easily overthrown, et cetera. So it's pretty darn good. So we're extremely lucky. If you live in one of these Western democracies, you may not appreciate fully just how lucky you are. If you live in a situation that isn't like that, you know how bizarre this is, the concept of people being able to open an Apple stand and sell apples or do anything that they want to do and trade with anybody that they want to trade. That's inconceivable under sort of dictator type governments. Now, the amount of human waste and suffering that's the result of the interventionist situations is pretty vast. The world that I envision is a world without the standard, you know, demo-publican interventionist politics, state-sponsored so-called science and medicine and education, you know, crippling guild systems for employment that give money and security to those who've got government protection and exclude others, et cetera. My vision is one of a border-free, worldwide market economy where labor, capital, ideas, et cetera, all are just compete in a worldwide marketplace to try to figure out who's got the best solutions and who's doing the best for the consumers and therefore who's doing it cheaper, better, faster, et cetera. That material advance certainly has to be, you have to have ground rules for all these things. You have to have civil and criminal legal systems. You have to have protection for the environment. You got to have a lot of things. It's complicated as hell. But in principle, the biggest single hurdle for humans is understanding the extraordinary value of freedom in this regard and not cherishing it and not understanding it. And so that is the single largest conceptual mistake that human beings are making, and it is costing untold amount of suffering and death in the world. When you see a bunch of little kids in India starving, you are not looking at a lack of government compassion. You're not looking at a lack of intervention. You're not looking at anything other than a society where people where history has not blessed them with a series of events that have made possible the freedoms that we have in the United States. Okay, they're so corrupt there that you just can't get anything done in a market process to save your life. This means that the little people suffer tremendously. And that's going on all over the world, and it goes on here. Okay, I met a young lady, very very smart girl, 4.0 student, Asian girl, carved her way out of Thailand to come to the United States, and she'd been here several years, sitting on a perfect record, and could not get into nursing school. And the reason she couldn't get into nursing school is she couldn't pass what was actually a very crafty and tricky English test. Now, I could understand her perfectly, and she could understand me perfectly, all the way to a sophisticated sense of humor. But when I looked at the test, it would have things like you had to know the difference between sail, S-A-I-L, and sail, S-A-L-E. And let me tell you, if you start splitting hairs on subtleties like that, this is a credentialing process that is keeping somebody out that we would be better off having in, as opposed to somebody not nearly as smart who knows the difference between those two words. So what is this? This is just a government guild system, you know, that is essentially not allowing a free market process for excellence to succeed and for less competent people to have to do things that are less complicated. So this is the biggest thing that stands between humans and their ability to have future generations have a better existence. It will happen anyway. I am exceedingly confident we'll never be able to see this, so I can say it boldly like I know what I'm talking about. But I'm looking at the march of history over the last 200 years. And when I see the next 200 years, I see an inevitable march towards greater and greater freedom. You're not going to be able to stop digital communication to reach every corner of the world, and people are going to find out how other people in the world are actually living, and they're going to find out that we're not joking. We have it unbelievably good, and so could you, and we're no smarter than you are, you've just got bad, corrupt, nasty, oppressive governments. And as people would understand this, and people within the United States would quit trying to work against it, and instead we peel back this interventionist, ridiculous, expensive, destructive activity that we do, we would find that we would have, you know, paradise. Is on as far as, you know, paradise is going to happen anyway, but it would happen much more quickly. And so that's where I would put my money, time, and effort if I had the resources.
So a couple of comments on the Facebook group came up as mm-hmm. a result of last week's show on this little topic. And mm-hmm. I had some of these similar thoughts as well. And the question is a lot of the innovation nowadays, well, not a lot of it, but some of the innovation has mm-hmm. to do with pleasure trap things. So the sex robots, pleasurable mm-hmm. food, all these things.
Sure.
And so as markets are allowed to essentially exploit our biological drives and the flaws and
yes.
the vulnerabilities from that, how do we protect ourselves from that? Or is it simply just, you know, the people who are X, Y, or Z personality traits able to get out of it will, and the people who don't have those traits won't ever get out of it?
Yeah, this is the price of freedom, is that you're going to have traps like this that are going to be available, and we can't. I always shudder. I have heard, I don't know how many times, in the hyper health arena, that we should ban sugar, we should ban meat, or we should ban this or ban that. It's like I can't. It's hard to believe that people think this way. You don't ban anything. People have choices. And when there are negative consequences to those choices, you have a free market in information. Hopefully you don't have a government dictating policy and an FDA deciding this, that, or the other, and you don't have government pamphlets telling people what's true and what isn't true, and you don't have government teachers telling students that are in a compulsory school system what it is that they're supposed to think and get right on the test. You have a free market of information where, you know, you have Khan Academy making a mockery of the universities of the world, okay, for free. So the truth of the matter is, if in principle you strip away people's reliance on government to tell them what to think and what's true, instead they have to be more sensitive to essentially free market processes, and they have to learn, and they have to listen, and they have to find out the way they do about everything else under the sun, which is use their brains, imitate other people, and listen and use their intelligence. And et cetera. And so you trust the fact that people are the best deciders for what it is that they ought to be doing, whether or not that's self-destructive or not. It's not like they're not going to find out. So it wasn't the government that helped people figure out that they maybe ought to be eating less animal food, dairy products, et cetera. It wasn't the government. It was a not very well-funded band of people that were interested in getting that message out to the public, and that they knew. Okay. So that's how that goes. So in the same way, I'm not interested in us dictating to anybody what their choices would be. You let people go where their interests go, and they find out for themselves how it is to manage any problems that come along the way.
Fantastic. And, you know, my parents came from socialist or, you know, communist Russia. And so the argument is mm-hmm. always, we can either starve under socialism or be overfed under capitalism. I think we would all have the freedom of being overfed.
Beautifully said. I've never heard that before. That's a fantastic encapsulation of exactly what we're talking about. Beautiful.
All right. So, yeah, thank you for that answer. That's that we've had that question in the queue for a little bit, and I'm glad we could put it in for this topic. So mm-hmm. let's move along to the altruism, kin selection, Hamilton's law. And this also, I guess, has to do with this ingrained, you've talked about in previous shows, about an ingrained morality compass. And so tell mm-hmm. us, I know this is kind of a long question, but mm-hmm. tell us a bit about those.
Okay. First of all, just a tiny little point of order. We don't call it Hamilton's law. We call it Hamilton's rule. Okay, so just a slightly different. So no worries. Okay. The Hamilton's rule is it's got a formal mathematical inequality. But what it is, it's the notion that it's also called inclusive fitness, which is the notion that an animal's success in life is not just how many children it has, but also whether or not its other relatives will also be successful. And so you can see that an animal isn't just in it for themselves. We can quickly see that they're out to that success in biological terms is essentially how many offspring did you leave on the planet. And so we can see clearly that biology is a competitive process of alternative individuals. Essentially, it ultimately becomes one of individual genes. Certain genes are more numerous than others because they are more successful at surviving and reproducing. Now, one of the characteristics of genes that are successful in certain species is genes that actually can, by some mechanism, statistically or definitely, recognize when their genes are located in another body. So a mother that gives birth, and then there's, you know, three little hamsters running around, the mother that knows that those three are hers, but there's three other hamsters that are not hers, the one that knows which are which and can recognize those individuals and has a way to detect those and then directs her resources towards those individuals, that's a hamster that's more successful than one that can't do that very well. And so this is the transfer of energy from that mother to offspring to increase offspring's likelihood of success. That is a, you could call that in principle self-sacrificial, because as she does that, she reduces her own chances of survival. She could be hiding in the ground. She could just be eating for herself, not venturing forth and getting exposed to predators. But instead, she takes these risks and gets these resources to give them to her offspring. That characteristic was built by genes that are more successful than genes that would just say, well, here we are sitting in a body, let's defend it as long as we can. Okay? So this is how we can start to see how the genes work. The genes are able to grasp, I say that in quotes, because the genes don't grasp anything. They're just automatons that code for proteins that build neural circuits that do the grasping. But we can think of them, if we want, just for fun, as if they're little conscious entities or calculating entities. So the genes are essentially building organisms that make decisions that optimize the survival of those genes wherever those genes are located. Now, it was Hamilton's insight that it doesn't stop at offspring. It also goes sideways in the gene pool to what we might call second-degree relatives. So this is going to be, for example, your nephew or niece. So now we have to start realizing that the impact of behavior is not just about the individual's survival or their direct reproduction. It's literally the sum total optimizing that animal's behavior with respect to optimizing its genetic success. So therefore, it might feed its nephew more than its own child if that same chunk of food would be, for example, the nephew is 25% of that individual's genes, the child is 50% of the genes. So if it could, with the same unit of food, more than double the impact on the survival of the nephew relative to its child, then it should feed the nephew rather than its child with that chunk of food. This is what Hamilton's rule is about, or is attempting to describe, that this kind of mathematics would have been shaped into animals, or actually it could be, it wouldn't necessarily be the case. Just because it would be possible wouldn't mean that evolution would find a solution, but it could. And it's clear that evolution is clearly made animal brains to be very helpful to their own offspring. And in fact, we found conditions where animal brains are helpful to second-degree relatives as well, like nieces and nephews. So now what we're going to do is we're going to use this to try to understand human action in what we call morality. So I think we would begin this discussion with a notion of what morality is. And so we're going to contrast it with what we would call amoral. So amoral actions are actions that we would look at those and say, basically, the individual did not consider the other party at all. They just took what they wanted. That would be amoral, or I guess we could call it immoral. But nature is amoral. So nature, basically, we don't expect animals to be considering the impact on others. We consider the cheetah to run down the Thompson's gazelle. That's that. We consider the leopard to intimidate the cheetah out of that Thompson's gazelle when it's half eaten, because it's in its best interest and it couldn't really care less about the interests of others. So throughout the animal kingdom, mostly what we see is amoral action. Now, we see highly considerate action in these tight Hamiltonian circles, like mother-child offspring considerations. But otherwise, what we see is essentially, quote, survival of the fittest. Too bad. Not really interested in the rules. And in human action, we consider sort of moral the issue that you've got humans living in groups where the impact of what it is that you do could have a significant negative impact on somebody else. In other words, you've got conflicts of interest with others. And so you have to be able to compute or manage the conflict of interest against, you know, your short-term seemingly best interest versus what the sum total of those interests are, the impact they have on other people, and then how this then essentially reduces the cooperativeness of group action and the cohesiveness of that group, and therefore reduces potentially the protection and benefits that you would get as a group living animal. So if it turned out that we didn't have, for example, if somebody turned their back and you ran and stole their food and just ran off and ate it, then the issue would be, is that, quote, the right way to live? And we know as people that that's not a good way to live, because now the expense of actually having to guard you for your food against thieving, freeloading flakes winds up being really high, and the value of being around those people is they're comparatively less, and therefore we may not have a cohesive system. We may not be able to live that way. So it's going to turn out that human beings evolved, quote, morality, which might be translated into let's consider others. So which means that you're computing, you're thinking, feeling, and considering others where there's conflicts between what appears to be your short-term best interest versus what is actually your long-term best interest, all things being computed. Now, nobody knows where this started. It certainly had mother-child need asymmetry, was undoubtedly involved in the evolution of moral sentiments. In other words, mothers undoubtedly are sensitive and worried about and concerned about the chirping of their own kid as opposed to the chirping of the kid next door. And so that's a natural sensitivity and sympathy that would be developed towards being very worried about the pain of others. You could see, however, we could step outside of this and we wouldn't have to be walking down the road of straight Hamilton's rule, we wouldn't have to be thinking about kinship. We could step outside of kinship and we would still find some roots of an interesting process that was probably associated with the evolution of morality in humans. And that would be grooming behavior that you'll see in primates and you'll see it in other animals as well. So I want you to think about a couple of birds who have some, you know, live in a jungle, and there's some worm that drops down from the trees, and it sometimes drops right down into a place in its back where it can start to eat away at the bird's skin and then cause infections and then reduce the likelihood of the bird's ability to survive. Now, the bird can't reach that worm itself, but if it's got a, quote, friend that will peck that worm, and you know what? You could just see how this could happen, see how behaviors like this could have easily evolved, because a bird might peck a worm anyway that's on the ground, right? So now if it turns out that you have a characteristic that you fly up close to your friend and you turn your back and fluff your feathers, and so your friend can see that there's a worm there and he pecks it, now we've got a situation where we've been able to potentially evolve a behavior pattern, takes advantage of some existing behavior patterns, but now we wind up with grooming behavior. And so grooming behavior, you can see how we could get a situation where one animal might do some grooming on another animal, and there might not be a worm there to eat. Eventually, what you might have is just one animal that's digging some nasty tick out of another animal's back, and it's not eating the tick. It's just digging it out of there, and it's helping the first animal. And the reason they're going to do this is not that it's Hamiltonian, because maybe they're not very closely related, so there's no Hamiltonian fraction there that's helping us. That what in fact is happening is that there's a tendency for them to reciprocate. So this is going to be what Trivers called delayed reciprocal altruism. And so this is also how you then get, you could get mutual grooming behavior where both animals are better off. Okay? So now you start to see how you could get, for example, sympathy circuits, that an animal that feels sympathetic and helpful towards another animal and goes to some trouble to actually invest some energy in digging ticks off the other animal's back, winds up then getting that same thing reciprocated to them. And you can see how this would be an interesting mathematical and practical and engineering problem in evolution, that you're going to get some people that are going to be wanting to cheat. So you're going to get people that, or excuse me, not animals, that show their back to another animal to have it pick the ticks out, but then they don't turn around and pick the ticks out of the other guy's back. So you're going to also then get grudge packing, where you're going to get animals that if you do that to them, then they don't ever groom you again. Okay? So you can start to see the evolution of behavior. Whether or not there's emotional sentiments that are marking it is irrelevant. So there might be people that would say, well, Doug, how do you, you know, do you really think that there would be sort of grudge packing, irritation, et cetera, in a baboon? I don't know. Okay, I really couldn't tell you. It wouldn't shock me if there were feelings of irritation about being shortchanged in baboon society, where somebody that was a lousy reciprocator would be less likely to wind up getting groomed. Okay, so I could see that as a possibility that they could actually have an evolution of such calculus and feelings, and therefore result in behavior. But we certainly know that it's true in humans. So humans meticulously keep track of how well other people help them. They have feelings towards those individuals. And now we're going to get to sort of one of the all-time discussions that always comes up when we start putting altruism and under the microscope and we start explaining it. And that is that, you know, a lot of people get upset when you start to explain that altruism is motivated like everything else, and that there's a cost-benefit analysis that guided the evolution of altruism and guides the calculations of individuals that are doing altruistic acts. And so people will swear up and down, no, I never want anything in return. You know, I've done these wonderful things and I never expected anything back. Okay. And to which I cry foul and I will say, yes, you did. Okay. And so what you can see the evolution of this process as it would look as follows. So let's suppose that you come across someone who is quietly crying. And what will happen is you will feel helpful. And the reason they are even making those noises of distress is because evolution has shaped them to make those noises, because those noises may actually succeed in bringing in an altruist that is going to spend some time and energy to make that individual's life better. And so as a result, what's going to happen is somebody may feel very sympathetic. So let's suppose it's you. And so you feel helpful and you feel sympathetic. You're motivated to try to figure out what's wrong. And as you, the degrees of those feelings and those motivations are actually being computed through a host of sophisticated algorithms that have been shaped by evolution. So, for example, let's just let's just put it this way. It's a pretty girl crying in the corner, and a man walks by and sees that she's seems to be very frustrated at her desk, and she's, you know, she just looks like she's all upset. Now, is he more likely to stop and be helpful for the pretty girl, or is he more likely to stop and help for a grandma who is making the same sniffles, a 68-year-old grandma, gray-haired, overweight, etc. Okay, which is he more likely to stop and help? I think we know. Okay, all things being equal, he's going to stop and help the pretty girl. Of course, this shouldn't surprise us any. And if anybody, you know, wants to debate that, we can look at the scientific evidence on that. We already know what the answer is. Now, sometimes people will help people that are very downtrodden and appear to have no assets to reciprocate, but they do. They've got a mouth. Okay, and so if we help them and they appear to have no ability to reciprocate, then that reputation that they helped me and yet there was nothing I could have done to reciprocate because I was in such bad shape will permeate the village, and our individual that did the helping will get extra kudos for having been someone that would have helped without any obvious possibility of having reciprocation. Okay, so and you say, well, what good is that? Well, it's worth a lot of good, because the more you are known for having done something that you weren't looking for anything in return, the more valuable of an insurance policy you are. So this is the apex of this as a sophisticated, deep strategy would have to be the mitzvah in Jewish religion. So the notion is that you're going to do something. You should do it because it's, quote, the right thing to do, and you do it without any hope of anybody knowing, and you do it quietly and anonymously. Well, let me tell you something. This is actually extraordinarily sophisticated way to try to look at this problem, only possible to people with a lot of smarts and a lot of delay of gratification. The notion is hopefully get caught doing a mitzvah. So you would, if you can set it up in such a way that it really looked like there was no, you know, there was no way that you were angling to get this thing found out. You did it all anonymously. Then what a beautiful thing to have been discovered. Okay. So this is, of course, how, you know, people would operate. They would operate on just this sophisticated enough level, depending upon the sophisticated of their particular neural circuitry. Notice that when you help, you feel good. The only reason why you would feel good is that if your statistical likelihood of gene survival rose, that's what good feelings are. So you would feel good because there's a statistical increased likelihood of your gene survival. So that feeling of being magnanimous that you helped, you know, et cetera, and it even looked to the other folks like you did it for, quote, no obvious gain. Well, good. Okay. The better they think that, the more cachet I've got, et cetera. Now watch carefully. The recipient of this, let's suppose that you just helped somebody and went to a bunch of trouble, and they said, thank you so much, et cetera, et cetera. They feel grateful. That's part of the evolution of their moral sentiments. So that feeling and communication of that feeling is essential, because it's essentially a system of accounting where human beings signal each other that I owe you. So that's what thank you means in human Stone Age language, okay? Thank you means I owe you. And so we can see the degrees of the acknowledgement of that debt when someone says, hey, could you help me with that? Hey, thanks. That means I don't really owe you. Thank you means I owe you. And thank you so much. I just can't tell you how much I appreciate that. That tells you that I owe you, and therefore, if I'm in a position to reciprocate appropriately at some later time, I will. Okay, so you feel good receiving that because you now have evidence that you've increased your likelihood of gene survival. You have Stone Age money in the bank. Now, so you feel appreciated and you feel good. Notice how irritated you are if you were to go to a bunch of trouble to help somebody and they did not say thank you. That is proof positive that human moral structure was designed by nature along delayed reciprocal altruism processes. If they do not say thank you when you have helped them, then you are angry. Anger is, again, a moral sentiment that is basically signaling the other individual that they are treating you unfairly, okay? And the purpose of anger is to activate its mirror image, which is guilt. So guilt is the moral mechanism to tell you that you have done something that is potentially going to reduce your likelihood of gene survival. In order, unless you hustle and get rid of this guilt, it's an unpleasant feeling. Anger is basically, you better do something and make sure that you collect on a debt because you've been treated unfairly. So that's an unpleasant feeling. So these unpleasant feelings are signaling devices that are actually part of an adjudication of fairness in an animal that has conflicts of interest between them living in a cohesive group process. So this is the moral sentiments. This is how this works. And it's all orchestrated. It can get more complicated. Sometimes people will do spectacular things that they could there could never be any direct reciprocation for that. But what there could be is it could be an increased statistical likelihood of mating because it's indicating great genes that you could afford to do some fantastic thing for other people. So there's other considerations here, and it can get fairly complicated in mapping out the little arrows associated with human experience, altruistic behavior, and the moral sentiments. But it's all there. It's all wired in. It's all part of human nature. And it is certainly not anything that needs to be taught. So we don't need church. We don't need school. We don't need teachers. And you don't even need parents for this. These are spontaneous activation of innate neural circuits that help an animal to orchestrate the conflicts of interest and the benefits of mutual interest and cooperation of a group living animal. So that's the nature of human morality and its roots and its basic functions.
Well, fantastic. It reminded me of it kind of filled in a little gap. I remember when I was in grade school my parents had me, we're visiting temple or something like that. We grew up Jewish.
Yeah.
And like you said, the highest level in Jewish tradition of altruism is where you donate a lot of something and you don't expect mm-hmm. anything in return. And so it's actually anonymous. And I remember one adult, they had their checkbook out and it was supposed to be all anonymous. And then they dropped the checkbook with the carbon copy of the check on the floor. And I'm sure, as a kid, I couldn't tell if it was on purpose or not. But, who knows if it was on purpose. But it could have just been, accidental, quote
right.
unquote.
Right. Exactly. Fair enough.
Yeah.
Got it.
And so a lot of these displays are simply, do you believe that they are consciously done? Because once in a while I hear people who they want to brag about how much they plan these things out. But when I see people's actions, they seem to be congruent with them just happening automatically. What can we infer about people who like to – oh, sorry.
Yeah. Sorry to interrupt you. God knows I'm through all the talking. You can do plenty more if you want.
Oh,
no. Yes, there's both going on. So we are often conscious. You aren't consciously directing anything. Your brain is what arrives in consciousness is the result of thinking that's going on unconsciously. And so you are aware of some of those unconscious processes as they arrive in consciousness, and you actually are consciously aware of some of the conniving that's going on. You are also not aware of some of the conniving that's going on. So sometimes are very clear about they are playing a chess game with other people's psychologies, and they know if I do this, he's going to think that, and then he's going to do this, and I'm going to do that, and when I do that, he's going to do this, and then when he does that, I'm going to do that, and then he's going to think, wow, what a cool guy, look what he did, okay? So we can think those things through like a chess game. And that doesn't mean we're bad people. It means our brains have computed that it's the cost benefit is worth actually going to the energy to try to game it out, to try to increase our odds of the result that we want. So if you're going to try to get Joseph Stalin to not, start World War III, or if you're trying to figure out how to stop, any nut to do anything from suing you, you try to game it out. and you try to figure out how it is that can I pull the levers in their nervous system. And so that's, there's nothing in the world wrong with that kind of directed Machiavellian, you know, plotting. It makes complete sense that we would have that capability, and we do have it. Anybody that tries to get their mom to give them a, you know, let them stay home from school, you know, I mean, is doing this. Now, the however, a great deal of actions in this regard, and a great deal of just naturally helpful, empathic, quote, altruistic action, it's just all done automatically. And let me point out, there's nothing in the world about this that is negative. The fact that a human being has the reason why we have arrived at this as a characteristic is because one unit of my effort might save the other person 100 units of life or more. So a day of my effort might save them 30 years of life because I spent a day saving their hide. Okay. So the fact that they owe me and that they are willing to pay me back, you know, 50-1 on that over the course of their lifetime, there's nothing in the world wrong with that. We have both benefited from my short-term altruistic behavior that took me one day out of my way on my other issues and therefore saved that person 30 years. Okay. So to say that the only way that this would be good is if I would do it without expecting anything in return is fanciful and absurd and ridiculous. And you can't evolve it. It can't be a characteristic of a species. Okay. It can't be characteristic of a species if it doesn't fall in line with inclusive fitness. If my spending that energy of one day of effort does not come back as one day of more survival or reproduction for my genes on Earth, then that behavior gets penalized by evolution and gets selected out by the Grim Reaper. So the fact that it's profitable doesn't mean we have to be Machiavellian and shitty and consciously calculating and devious or anything else under the sun. It means we can be what we are, which is a pretty darn pleasant species, okay? If you set up circumstances with good rules, with firm boundaries and a solid alpha, et cetera, like you have in Western democracies, then you can have a very, very pleasant life experience, and you can get quite a bit of altruistic behavior that's going to be very helpful, okay? And everybody's better off behind it. So the hopefully, I mean, obviously this is one of these almost sophomoric discussions, except that people do get twisted up about the fact that they have altruistic, pleasant, very helpful feelings, and they feel like possibly the glare of evolutionary psychology basically says, no, that's just a bunch of selfish gene-motivated crap. No, it's not. It's not at all. Okay? This is the fact that the genes have built systems for you to have those feelings and to take those actions under certain conditions is completely reasonable. That's a wonderful thing. The fact that it doesn't have you take those actions under all conditions just proves to you how sophisticated it is. Okay? If Charles Manson were in my prison and he fell down and was having a cardiac arrest and I had just been trained to give CPR, I guarantee you I would not give him CPR. Not a chance. Okay? In fact, in all my time, you know, several thousand prisoners that I worked with over 10 years, I can think of, I think, two guys, maybe three, that I'd give CPR to, right? That's it. Okay, why? It's not that they're all terrible people. Hey, it's me calculating my personal best interests, right? So that's how that works. That doesn't make me, you know, that doesn't make me less or bad or anything else. Mother Teresa, I don't know anything about her, and, you know, that's no goal for humanity to be phenomenally selfless in any bizarre way at all. Our job here is to do a good job at living, to be very, to be as happy as we can, and to, you know, be benign and helpful within the reasonable range of our interests.
Fantastic. Now, really quick question before we end. What can you infer about someone who, someone I know for a long time, we've talked about evolutionary psychology and this kind of ideas of altruism and Hamilton's rule, now that I know it's a rule, not a law. But they have said very often that it irritates them or it feels morally wrong when people are so calculating, regardless of whether or not it, you know, ends up being in both people's best interest. What can we infer about that?
Well, I think that what you're hearing is that when you are calculating, that in essence you're looking at deception. So, in other words, so the person who is doing the calculating and is gaming it out in their head is probably using some deception in order to set a chain of dominoes in a row so that they can get the reactions that they're seeking. So that is probably, so it's kind of disturbing this individual because they can sniff this. And nobody likes to be, quote, played. You don't like the fact that people might deceive you, even if they're being helpful, in some kind of crafty way for you to not understand what all the motivations are. Okay? So, but, you know, sorry, welcome to the real world. Okay? This is part and parcel of human behavioral dynamics. So the reason why people might do that is because you have something that they value and they're not sure that they can get that any other way. And so that's why it is that they feel like it's in their best interest to be a little bit crafty about what all their computations are and to cloak from you some of those computations while they can go about the business of getting whatever it is that they value most. In that process, they may be very helpful. They may be very altruistic. They may, in fact, I've seen many cases of this where the altruistic person way overshoots what it is that they needed to do to guarantee that resource on the other side, but they did it anyway. They had to play very, very carefully in order to make sure they got a document signed, that they got a letter of recommendation, et cetera, or whatever it was that the planning committee allowed them to build their garage, okay? Very often people need, you know, feel the need to be careful because the other side of a transaction may hold far too much power in some way, morally, legally, physically, or otherwise, monetarily. And so as a result, people sometimes feel they need to be crafty. And that, you know, the fact that they do so and that they can manipulate us in ways that we're not seeing all their computations because they've cloaked them, this is just part of life. The more you happen to be in a position where you have a resource that people value a lot and they can't figure out how to get to it, the more likely they're to be deceptive. I'm reminded that long ago, Bella DiPaolo, who is a fine experimental social psychologist, did research showing some of her research was is that highly attractive women were better at detecting deception than everybody else. And her inference was, that's because they have been lied to more often. So that made some sense.
That reminds me of that TV show Lie to Me. I watched a couple of episodes and one of the characters, mm-hmm. they asked her if she's had any deception detection experience. And she said, yep, I've dated a lot of men. And of course, that's exactly.
Fair enough.
What it is. All right, Dr. Lyle, thank you so much. The wonderful answers. Great little topic on Hamilton's rule, altruism, kin selection, and which where you would direct your resources if they were unlimited.
All cool.
All right, fantastic. Have a wonderful night. Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.